There's been a lot of talk since events of September the 11th, 2001, about just how many people must hate America. And it did take an awful lot of hate for those men to do what they did that day. But I don't think people around the world hate us. I just don't think they understand us. And the reason is they cannot understand our form of government. Now, if you think about it, this is excusable. If we lived in a country under a dictator, the whim of an army, or the political party of the day, it would be impossible for us to understand a government that did not operate under the personality of a dictator or the force of arms. America operates under a contract, a simple piece of fading parchment stored lovingly under glass in the National Archives. People in third world countries just can't imagine how America has operated basically the same since the late 1700s. Oh, yeah, we've gone on foreign wars. We've had our own territory invaded. We've seen political administrations with scandals. We've had riots in the streets, even had a civil war. But the focus of America has never changed. That's because of that contract, one that was formed in the past with a future. And we've kept that contract all these years. But now, we've got to go back to the beginning. We have to realize the Revolutionary War dragged on for 5 long years, and people were sick of it. Thousands had been killed or maimed, homes burned, flocks and herds destroyed, whole families were shamed, men were hanged for treason. Everybody wanted it to end. It's amazing when we look back how we, quote, won the Revolutionary War. We had some battles that ended in victory, but George Washington, bless his heart, in all his wisdom, just prevented our American ragtag army from losing very often. The only battle we can say we won and was spectacular was the last one at Yorktown. We wouldn't even have won that if the French fleet hadn't come to our rescue. Now wait, don't turn me off. I know what we think about the French today, but I'm going back now over 200 years when they really were our friends. So, since it wasn't a decisive victory, it would take time to win the peace. It was like we had the ball, we were 1 point up when the game ended. It would take 2 long years of hard negotiations in Paris before the British would sign on the dotted line. You realize we're the only nation that ever staged a successful revolution and then didn't destroy itself? We emerged victorious both in the battle and in the winning of the peace. So, whom did we send to Paris to talk for us? None other than a sharper-than-attack negotiator with freedom on his mind 24 hours a day named John Adams. But he wasn't alone. He had a little companion with him, Benjamin Franklin. These guys had to have been the original odd couple. Franklin was living in Europe when the war started, but he wanted to fight in the Revolution, so he came home. But he loved Paris. Those Parisian knights and Parisian women held a fascination for him unlike anything you can imagine. So when they asked him to go back to negotiate with John Adams, not only was he ready, his bags were packed and he was on the gangplank saying, "Come on, John, let's get back to Paris." That's why John Adams called him a dirty old man. That he's a womanizer. He drinks too much. Stays out too late. Not only that, he apologizes too much. You see, they were the good guy, bad guy combination. John Adams would step up and make a point in the negotiations in his scholarly manner. The British would reject it. Then little Benjamin Franklin would step up in his grandfatherly way and say, wait. Hey, let's talk about this. But the chemistry worked. It allowed us to negotiate in a way that the British understood. But now, as we say in show business, we have to fade to black and come up on a new scene. Because about halfway through these negotiations, we almost lost the peace 3,000 miles away right here at home. And would have, had it not been for something that George Washington did that very few people even know about. As I tell students in school, they're trying to rewrite history. I'm going to bring you up to snuff on a few points you're not aware of. George Washington heard there was talk of mutiny among his troops. He had moved his army to a little town about an hour north of New York City called Newburgh. These poor guys were so tired and miserable from fighting. They were underfed, underclothed, underpaid. They said, "Let's just disband the army. Let's take what little freedom we have back to our families. We'll trust Adams and Franklin to negotiate for us in Paris." But George Washington knew if word got to Paris that he no longer had an army, then Adams and Franklin would never be able to negotiate from a position of strength. He had to do something to prevent this mutiny. So one night, he called his top aides together. They met in a long wooden building just outside of Newburgh called the Temple. It's not only still there, today it's a national shrine. You'll know why in just a minute. George Washington had written letters begging these men at the Continental Congress to give him something in writing. He said, "I'm going to lose the army. They're going to leave. I've got to have something to keep the men in together." Finally, one legislator wrote him a rather glowing letter that basically said, "Hang in there. We're going to sign the treaty, and when we do, we'll move on. Then the heroes, the revolution, will be rewarded." George Washington took that letter, strolled up to the front of the hall, turned around and shocked his men when he said these words, "Gentlemen, during the prosecution of this war, I've not only gone gray but almost blind." He opened the left side of his coat, reached in a little vest pocket and pulled out a tiny pair of glasses and put them on. This is the first time his men had ever seen him wear a pair of glasses. He opened the other side of his coat, reached in and pulled out that letter, unfolded it, held it close to his face and read it slowly. When he finished, he refolded that letter, put it back in his coat, removed those tiny glasses, and put them back in his vest pocket. He stood there for several seconds, looking around the room at his men. Without saying one other word, he left the building. Historians who report the event of this evening tell us very little of what was in that letter. But they unanimously agree that in every diary of every man that had been in there had been written where everyone in the room cried. Because George Washington, a father figure, had shown them how vulnerable and fragile and frail he really was. And in so humbling himself in that manner, had shown them how vulnerable and fragile and frail is freedom. When they reported this to the rest of the troops, never again was there talk of mutiny among his men. So when we read in our history books about George Washington being the father of our country, that's not some hype from the 1700s. What he did that night, pouring his heart out to his men, literally saved America's freedom. But that's not all he did, as I'll recount in just a moment. Time passes, the treaty's signed, and Adams and Franklin come home. There's only one thing left. What in God's name do we do next? 55 wild-eyed radicals, rabble-rousers, heavy drinkers met in a building in Philadelphia and locked themselves up in the hottest part of the summer to answer that very question. What do we do next? We forget they could have done anything they wanted. They won the war and secured the peace. That was their call. Some of them wanted to reestablish the monarchy and put George Washington in as king. But others joked, "No, we don't want another king, George." Then they looked at all the nations in the past who had risen to their zenith and yet failed and asked one simple question. What went wrong? They looked at the famous charter, the Magna Carta, but this had been forced on a king by a bunch of land-owning barons whose only concern was the rights of the wealthy, and the people be damned. They looked at what was traditional structure of government, power at the top, trickle down slowly, but seldom if ever to the common man, and they turn this world upside down. Our founding fathers said, take everything off the table. We'll start from scratch. We'll build a government no one has ever dreamed of. They realized immediately no structure is good without a solid foundation. So they looked at the strongest geometric form there is, the triangle. It's the only thing it can't implode. It can't fold in against itself. They said, we'll build a government with an independent branch at the tip of each point of the triangle. Executive, legislative, judiciary. So, dear friend, together, these three branches made up the base of the government of the United States of America. When they started drawing up the bylaws, they made it look like a business. In fact, they invented a new term, CE, Chief Executive. We still call the president that. The White House is the executive mansion. They knew what an executive was, but they hadn't even thought of the word president. So as our founding fathers toiled those hot days and evenings in Philadelphia to put a new face on the executive branch, to disassociate it from the kingdoms of Europe and the potentates of the rest of the world, every time they were stymied on some point, their eyes would gaze up to the front of that hall, and sitting there was the president of the Constitutional Convention, George Washington. In many ways, our presidency was designed in the image of that man, George Washington. Looks a lot like him. That's why he became the first president of the United States of America. When they drew up the charter, they signed it, but they didn't sign it like we would have. We would have said, we the undersigned. No, as we all know, they said, we the people of the United States of America. Power from the bottom up. And they didn't just sign it for themselves. They said, we add our posterity, which means before you and I were born, before our parents were born, before our parents' parents were born, our names were already on that document. They made copies of it and sent it out to the 13 colonies, which had now become states. They said, what do you think? Everybody liked it. Yes. As more copies were distributed, though, more people sat around those pot-bellied stoves at the general store or town hall meetings and blacksmith shops, schoolhouses, church buildings, or just around the supper table at home, people began to question one thing. Freedom. Freedom. Too much freedom is too much power. This big bucket of stuff that belongs to all of us is ill-defined in many ways. Yeah, I like it. I like it. What are we going to do if 50 years from now we elect a Catholic for president? We going to take orders from Rome? What if I'm arrested? Will I have the right to know what for? They put troops in my house when we're at war. Can they do that again? Will it be a trial? Will it be bail? Will it be a jury?
Who will make up the jury?
Will I ever have to testify against myself? Can I keep my gun? Will anyone in government ever try to tell me how to pray? One state wanted 9 amendments. One wanted 17. Another wanted 25. So back to our founding fathers it went. This time they met in New York. And once again, as our historians say, between bouts of heavy drinking, they sat down to redefine exactly what freedom meant. And they did. 10 amendments were added to our original Constitution. We call those 10 the Bill of Rights. And the last one simply says, any freedom that's not earmarked for use by the federal government or assigned to the states shall belong to the people. A magic, revolutionary concept put together by a bunch of young men. Most of them were lawyers. One was a shoemaker. On December the 15th, 1791, the Bill of Rights was ratified, and more signatures went down on that document. Constitution Hall is indeed hallowed ground. Something magic, something wonderful happened there. The hand of God, a supreme being, fate, call it what you will, sat beside those young men, because from the creation of their minds came something completely new that still works. That's because they had sense enough to make it amendable. They knew times would change, and they put that down when they added our names. But something else makes me think that America is indeed a blessed land. The number of coincidences that have occurred. On the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, John Adams was now an old man, and he was lying in bed dying. You know what he talked about? He talked about those golden days in Philadelphia when he and those other young men gave birth to America. And just before he parted this earth, his thoughts ran to that tall, lanky, red-haired Virginian who penned the Declaration 50 years prior. He said to his family, "At least Thomas Jefferson still lives." But that was before the days of telephone and instant communication. What he did not realize, 2 hours earlier, almost 50 years to the instant that the document had been signed, Thomas Jefferson had died. On the 55th anniversary, the fifth president of the United States, James Monroe, died. 1 week before the 60th anniversary, James Madison became gravely ill. His folks wanted him to live just a little longer at the anniversary, but it was not to be. On June the 28th, 1836, James Madison died. A courier rushed to the White House to tell the president, and the man who got that message was the one most responsible for our westward expansion. He was a Tennessee Mountain man, a hero at the Battle of New Orleans, a man so much in love with the concept of the people that so many traipsed through the White House to congratulate him on his inauguration. They had to replace the carpets because they were caked with mud. Andy Jackson heard that James Madison had died, and he went to his room and shook and sobbed. No, not because he loved James Madison so much, but the news of his death hit him like a ton of bricks. You see, up to that moment, any member of Congress, any Supreme Court justice, any president of the United States who had any question about what was written on that document could have called their old friend James Madison in. Hey, come here. Come here. What did you guys mean? What's this freedom of speech? What is this right to bear arms? What is this thing you created? But you see, when James Madison died, the last founding father died. The last tangible link to the past was gone. I'm sure President Jackson must have felt that up until then the ship of state had always sailed in sight of land, but now he and every succeeding president would have to take it into uncharted waters. But not really, because there is a chart. There was then, there always will be. It's that fading, cracking document. If the men and women of the National Archives would just let us hold it, we could hold it in the palm of our hands. All of America's freedom. Not the might of an army. Not the will of a dictator. But words in the palm of our hands. You know, when those terrorists struck New York, I thank God they didn't take down one thing. That's the Statue of Liberty. As long as that gentlewoman stands in the harbor holding that torch, the vacancy lamp is lit and the welcome mat is out. But sadly today, many Americans think of immigration as the great evil. And with the flood of illegal immigrants coming in, this may very well be. But I'm not talking about them. I'm going back over 200 years ago, when the influx of men and women from every nation on the face of this earth produced that incredible interwoven patchwork quilt that is the texture of our society. It's indeed our strength. Many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were legal immigrants. They weren't born here. They came here. And when they realized how sweet freedom tasted, they were willing to put their names on that document and pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. No, America is not, as some would say, an elevator, that once you enter, you want the doors to close. If you need proof of this, just read what's on the base of the Statue of Liberty. Many can quote it, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free." But if that's all you know, you don't know it. You see, that's just the third verse. A wonderful Jewish lady named Emma Lazarus wanted to help raise money to build the pedestal. The French gave us the statue, but we had to build the base. When you realize the size of the statue, the base had to be enormous. School children contributed pennies. Emma Lazarus contributed a poem. When she realized what the size of the statue would be and what it would look like, she was reminded of another statue in another harbor at another time, the fabled Colossus of Rhodes, one of the wonders of the ancient world. You see, guarding the harbor of Greece was a giant warrior whose open legs spanned the water. Friendly ships sailed in and out of the harbor between his legs. He was so big it was visible 5 miles at sea. This giant warrior held a torch high in the air, but that torch was to keep people away. It lasted 59 years. Emma Lazarus compares that Greek statue to ours. Listen to its words. They're so powerful, so filled with electricity. When I get to the third verse, suddenly it will make more sense than you ever knew. These are all the words on the base of our Statue of Liberty. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name is Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor where twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me, you're tired, you're poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. No, dear friends, people around the world don't hate us. They just don't realize why we love our great country, our form of government. Yes, I'm indeed proud to be an American. God bless America.